Garner Ted Armstrong.
Humanity has symptoms of a deep disease, a sickness. Here we are in a world divided against itself, stockpiling weapons by which we can annihilate ourselves by three separate methods. Trembling on the brink of nuclear insanity, a world of growing and mounting crime, of dissidence, a world where many a nation is in a state of flux. More than 40 wars since World War II and others going on all the time, principally Vietnam. A world of such hair-raising problems, most people simply refuse to think about them. And paradoxically, a time when people are playing, escaping reality, drifting into their own ready-made daydreams, refusing to admit conditions are real and problems are as bad as they are, and all around us are the fruits of a growing subculture of escapism, of hippies, LSD trippers, drug addicts. The meanwhile, the average citizen unaware of a fantastic gambling binge, growing alcoholism, drug addiction, avalanches of pornography, growing dissidence and dissolution of society in general. And our society is coming apart at the seams and few people realize it. And when you tell most people the extent of the problems in the affluent countries, the have nations of the Western world, so many people I meet will tell me, oh, these problems aren't any worse than they've ever been. It's just better reporting. That there were always alarmists in all ages and days that told us that we were all going down to that other place, that society was shot, it was doomed, that we were all going to soon be fleeing from the wrath to come, but they say it never happened, and people say conditions aren't much worse than they have ever been. Well, part of the taking of the pulse of our sick society would be admitting, first of all, the tremendous number of dropouts there are from society, not just school, but society. And the growing use of hallucinogens, various drugs that have mind-altering effects. Now, in Britain, it seems that here we find a nation. You people in Britain don't like to admit this, but you better perk up and listen, it's the truth. That is in deep trouble, deep economic, moral, spiritual, physical, and mental trouble. A nation that from the pinnacle of the greatest military power at the end of World War II has plummeted down to become a third-rate power, now trying frantically to get inside the growing economic powers of the European common market. With troubles in the Commonwealth and troubles at home, troubles of mind and of heart and spirit. Not the finest hour, the worst hour of Great Britain. And in Britain, as if to cap off the horrible gambling binge there today, the British government has announced recently plans to make significant changes in its present policy of allowing any doctor to prescribe free drugs to an addict. Because abuses of this system, which have been viewed as enlightened by some experts, has contributed to an alarming increase in heroin addiction, up 1,000% in 7 short years. Now, the National Health Service in Britain provides free prescriptions. So drugs only cost the bus fares to a doctor's office and the chemist's shop to get them on the way home. But Britain's growing narcotics problem is small by comparison with most other countries, particularly the United States. There are known to be more than 1,000 in Britain and 670 on heroin, while police officials estimate the real number to be 3 times larger. It remains minuscule compared to the 40 to 60,000 estimated in New York City alone and 100,000 in the whole of the United States. But the rate is rising, and narcotics agents, police departments are alarmed. Tenfold in 7 years, and heroin addiction among youths under 20 has more than tripled in the last single decade. Now, the Times of London reported from Portsmouth, England, how alleged cases of children attending school while suffering the after effects of drug taking were mentioned at a meeting of Portsmouth Health Committee attendants and people who were concerned about public health in Portsmouth. Mr. Edward Sheen said, "I've heard of cases of children going to school in a groggy condition, apparently suffering from the after effects of taking drugs the night before." Now, the Evening Mail and Dispatch in Birmingham said 5% of the estimated teenage population of Birmingham are on the borderline of drug addiction. According to a report being published by the Birmingham research team, 2% are already addicted, they claimed, and nearly half the city's teenagers, listen to this, one of the great cities of Great Britain, nearly half the city's teenagers have tried drugs at some time or other. Staggering percentages. These are the leaders of the world tomorrow. the leaders of the world, the age that you hope will be created to bring us peace and prosperity and happiness at last. The leaders of tomorrow's commerce, industry, government, religion. And today, increasing large segments of our teenagers are going off the deep end, dropping out from society, trying every kind of temporary, passing thrill and sensual physical or mental pleasure they can possibly poke at themselves, because they simply aren't convinced there will be a world here tomorrow. They're scared and don't like to admit it. They're completely disillusioned and filled clear up to here with the ideas of the older generation. They look around them and see nothing but hate. They see racial hate and religious bigotry and confusion among nations. They see a growing arms race. They see horrifying accidents. They see older people that can't get along. Millions of broken homes, divorce spiraling upward, and crime mounting everywhere. And so come the protest movements, the walkouts, the teach-ins and sit-ins, the protest against anything and everything that smacks of the older generation and authority, a protest against life itself. And millions of these unhappy kids are wrecking their own lives, and instead of producing something better, instead of not only admitting the problems of the older generation and showing something better, showing causes and then finding solutions, it reminds you of these programs that are gaining headway today. Newspaper columns, radio, TV, every kind of media you can imagine, it seems to portray a people who like to sit back and carp and gripe and nag and harangue about all the problems. It's sort of descending into the you did, you didn't idea. He did, he didn't. You did, no, I didn't. Arguing back and forth, accomplishing nothing. But it seems like many of these methods of getting to the public, the harebrained idiocy and the boobishness and the addle-headed mess of many people's thinking today, is doing nothing more than convincing us there are a lot more weirdies out there than we thought there were. And apparently they point out all of the hates, all of the nutty and the weird ideas, the idiots who could help themselves but don't, and thousands of hours are spent in griping and complaining and nagging and pointing out all of these problems. But you begin to wonder, what is the product? What do they stand for? What is positively offered as a solution? What is the goal of such attempts? Is it to create actual healthy change? Is it to stimulate the beginning of a solution, or is it only to descend in all this carping and griping, you did, you didn't, for the sake of complaining about the status quo of conditions? It looks like many of them try to discredit. They try to defame, to abuse, and oftentimes to expose obviously idiotic notions and make them public. But what do they accomplish by doing this? What positive program do they present instead of some of the idiocy of today? Well, like the teenagers who seem to have nothing to offer, and I don't mean all teenagers, I need to hasten to say that, because of course I'll get a few letters right quickly saying, well, you seem to think all of us teenagers this way. No, I don't either. I know that many teenagers are not, but I know as well as you do that all too many of them are dropouts from society. They don't have any hope, and not very many people have been giving them much hope for the future. And so they're descending into the use of not only alcohol, but even more bizarre forms of escapism, mental hallucinations, various drugs such as LSD and another one now that bypasses the legal restrictions of LSD for short trips only. It is known as DMT. At one time used in certain South American snuffs, this drug is replacing the hallucinogen LSD in some circles. And that's because its basic ingredient is easier to obtain, even the lysergic acid, because the passage of legislation was aimed chiefly at LSD, so they find a loophole, and now they're going to try to get visions that last only 45 minutes. Did you hear the story the other day about the kid who had taken LSD some months before, and from that time on had been subjected to weird hallucinations and went completely off his rocker? And finally, because his brain was so completely gone, he wrote a completely incomprehensible suicide note and blew his brains out. You can tell about the one of the kid who sniffed glue and tried to stop a runaway, well, maybe it wasn't runaway, but at least a railway train with his bare hands, and of course the train won. And it doesn't scare anybody. For some reason, there's not enough education about the horrifying possibilities of the use of such drugs, and neither is there any hope, any encouragement from church, from family, from school, from the society, from any and everybody in general, to give teenagers the absolute conviction that there is a wonderful world tomorrow they can inherit. If they just had the guts, if you'll pardon me saying it, and the courage to look beyond all of the carping and the ridiculing of today's sick society and to see what the future really holds. Now, I'm not going to be classified as one of these alarmist, griping programs that does nothing but tell you all the problems, that tells you all the horrible news of today without something positive to offer in its place. I've got something positive to offer, and this is going to happen whether you like it or not. What I offer is not something you need to join or you need to subscribe to make it happen. What I offer is the good news of what kind of a world there will be tomorrow in spite of today's sick society. Not more and more bad news about the sick society, but the good news of the world tomorrow. And that good news was brought to this earth nearly 2,000 long years ago. It was rejected. It was ignored. The message was totally perverted. It's been completely watered down. Most people don't even begin to realize that of all people, Jesus Christ of Nazareth foretold our day, foretold our sick society, told us it would be coming apart at the seams, foretold the awesome and the big worldwide trends of growing drought and famine, of the population explosion, of the stockpiling of weapons that would mean the extinction of society if they got out of hand. He foretold all of that. But he also, through his apostles and others, even foretold the personal little idiocies and hates of people, foretold the mental attitude of humanity today, and then offered the positive solution, which is going to occur. Told the good news beyond. Now, frankly, it's always darkest just before the dawn, and you're going to be reading an awful lot of rotten bad news yet. This good news I'm talking about is still for the future, but the nearer future. A lot closer now than we begin to realize. And it doesn't depend on you accepting it or believing it. I'm not asking you to believe something. I'm just telling you. It's going to be that way. Jesus Christ of Nazareth said in the focal point of all prophecy in Matthew 24 that the good news of the coming world government of God, who does exist and whose existence I can prove to you if your mind is open. Now, if you're a prejudiced, biased bigot, nobody is going to make you believe anything you don't want to admit into your own mind. But if you are a truly objective person, willing to at least listen to the opposition, if you would call it that, willing to question and to quest and to get the proof and the truth of a matter, like the Bereans who searched the scriptures daily whether certain things were true or not. They didn't carp and gripe and say you did, you didn't, and make fun of the way somebody pronounces a word or the part of the country he's from or the color of his skin or his height, shape, weight, and texture of hair and color of eyes. They didn't dodge behind the most ancient, old human escapism of all. Who does he think he is? You talk about a dumb statement. That's one of the dumbest of all time. And that's the ancient adage that people use. They resort to personal ridicule when they can't answer, when they can't disprove, when they can't objectively and with their intelligence and their mind sit down and reason calmly together. What about you? Now, I know that you'd have to admit with me the world's too full of bigots. You're not one, are you? Well, if you're not, then what about writing for a free booklet on the world tomorrow, what it's really going to be like? I've got a booklet here that will tell you exactly what kind of a world you're going to be living in. Tells you how to solve all of these problems. It tells you how mental health is going to be altered and changed. It tells you how one world language is going to be put into effect. It tells you, in summarizing the entirety of the message of Jesus Christ, exactly what kind of a government it was of which he spoke, approximately when it's going to be set up, who will be its chief leaders, who will be in which bureau, which department, which members of which cabinet, who are going to be administrating which facet or function of government. It tells you what about the military. Even weather change. Now you read the claims of science about altering weather, living in a kind of a controlled bubble that they might create for us. But what about the truth? What will really happen? You see, most predictions of the future tend to oscillate between the wildest optimism and the deepest gloom. Some of them tell you about a fantastic Disneyland of gadgetry and push-button ease and pleasure, and others tell you we're going to blast ourselves into an incinerated hulk. And you don't seem to see predictions about the future that take it all into account, that tell you the problems are real, face them squarely, tell you the possibilities of survival, tell you exactly what will happen. That's what the message of Christ really does. Now, you thought that Christ was a little Lord who was a misunderstood teacher, maybe a dropout of his time. You know, a lot of these young people that went to wear long hair. And incidentally, Christ didn't, and that is one of the most laughable things you can imagine when you find what a horrible shock it's going to be to some people when they discover Christ had short hair. That the earliest pictures of him had short hair, of course, they're probably not accurate pictures even so, but that the Bible itself says, distinctly, it is a shame for a man to wear long hair. I take it that means a real man. You might think about that, but that's what the Bible says. Well, Christ was not some kind of a bearded dropout of his day that was just a misunderstood teacher that wanted to sing protest songs. Christ came with an advanced message about coming world-ruling government. He came as an advance emissary of something that will happen, a government from afar that is going to inherit and rule this earth. Why is it such a shocking thing to professing Christians to be told that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is alive? Well, many people pick up a police gazette or some of the magazine and promptly believe Hitler's alive. The Filipino people believed General MacArthur when he said he would return. But the entire professing bulk of Christendom, and I say that as a broad generality, I'm not talking about everyone, because many people do hope and expect that Jesus Christ is alive and that he will return. But it's the whole emphasis of the New Testament. The entire hope of the Christian given in Revelation 2:26 and 3:21 is rulership, is the inheritance of a position of power in a world-ruling government. Every great parable that Jesus spoke, trying to illustrate his message, trying to tell people what he stood for and what he was all about, talked about government. It talked about the relationship of people in overcoming, the relationship of their overcoming their own human nature to their basic inherent ability. How well they could put down their jealousies, their lust, their greed, and their hatred with the power of the Spirit of God and by repenting and admitting to themselves that they are, after all, only flesh and filled with a lot of idiotic notions of and by themselves unless they get their minds straightened out. And that the more they overcame themselves and their around the human society and a great being of whom this world seems to know little, who is also mentioned in the Bible, Satan the devil, that directly proportionate to the amount of their overcoming, directly proportionate to the amount of their understanding, of their grasp of the overall problems, of their overcoming of their own human nature, getting rid of their lust, of their covetousness, of their narrow-minded bigotry and their jealousy, getting hate out of their hearts, getting religious bias out of their hearts, getting rid of the lust of the flesh, the eyes, the ear, getting rid of and totally repenting of the idea of satisfying every physical, sensual lust of the eye, of the taste buds, even a desire to drift off into hallucinations of the mind so as to deny reality. Totally vomiting all that up and getting rid of it and repenting. That's what Christ said. Overcoming, becoming a different person. A person of honesty, of integrity, of ability. A person of a sound mind. How do you qualify to govern? You ever heard anybody make a speech yet who was trying to gain political office who told you what kind of a rotten fink he'd been in his past life? Ever hear anybody admit what a crook he'd been? Do you ever hear anybody tell you, well, I know I'm a dirty crook, and I've probably done an awful lot of dirt in my life. I've been a real clod. My former life, every time I tried to express an opinion about something, I have to admit now that it was just a lot of bigotry and a lot of jealousy and hate and greed, a lot of racial bias and religious teaching I got from my parents and people around me. I'd never checked, never proved, never looked into anything. You ever hear anybody talk like that? Talk about what a complete jackass he'd been. I can show you a few people like that around, and I can read to you A statement from one, or more than that, but several. But there is one in particular. Name was Paul. It was changed from Saul. That meant destroyer. And he wrote 14 books of the New Testament of the Bible. And he said he was injurious. He said he was an absolute stench in God's nostrils. He said he persecuted the very church of God. He called himself the offscouring of all things. He said, you talk about an unqualified sinner. I'm the chief of all. He said, I'm not worth two hoots in a whirlwind. But somehow, he said, God Almighty has looked down and picked me up out of the slop and put my chin on the curb and let me breathe fresh air and called me to do a job, and I'm doing it. Now people persecuted him. He was called before governors, rulers, kings, and they said, Paul, who do you think you are? You know, he was asked by Agrippa one time. I might even read that to you, because I have the Bible here before me, so I'll turn to it. He was asked by Agrippa, just what is all this business, Paul? You getting involved in all these arguments with these Jewish people about whether or not there's a resurrection of the dead and the like. Now here you are on your way to go see Herod, and you could have been let free a long time ago. You know, he was having to defend himself against an orator who was one of the kind of a carper and griper types of his day. He was the type that had all the oration. He could really sling the rhetoric around. He was a real nut, too, because he was about as bigoted as they come. His name was Tertullus, and he was a professional orator. The way he got his money, he didn't have to believe in any particular cause, but if somebody wanted him to go and harangue somebody, they'd hire him, and this Tertullus would show up, and he'd begin to harangue. And he was a real... Well, you'll have to judge for yourself when you hear what he said. Here's what he said. It's in the 24th chapter of the book of Acts, and the Apostle Paul is in Herod's judgment hall, and he's on trial for his life. Now, here comes this Tertullus, and he'd been hired, and when Paul was called forth, you read in verse 2, this is history, chapter 24 of the book of Acts, that's right after the Gospels, in case you're wondering, in the New Testament, and he was speaking here, and he said, seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by your providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that you would hear of us of thy clemency, a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also have gone about to profane the temple. Every last one of those things, an absolute lie. Now, there were a pack of peoples who called themselves by a certain name then. There were various ringleaders of various sects, but of course, Paul had nothing to do with any of them. He had not profaned the temple. As a matter of fact, he'd just gotten through going the wages and the charges himself for somebody to take a vow on himself and shave his head and do exactly what those in the temple said he should. He hadn't stirred up a thing, but his persecutors had. Every last one of these things, an absolute hired lie. But this hired orator, he didn't have any character. He wasn't trying to get into God's kingdom and government. He wasn't trying to overcome. He was just trying to get back at somebody who'd gotten under his skin. And Paul's message had made him good and mad. So this chief captain Lysias, he said, came upon us, verse 7, and with great violence took him out of our hands. That also was a lie, incidentally. If you want to read the chapters before, you'll find that it was. Well, finally, Paul was given the opportunity to speak, and he said he was going to answer cheerfully, and he said in verse 13 of that chapter, neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. Now listen to what he said. See if this jives with what you've always thought. But this I confess unto you, that after the way, it is a way then, the way, a way of life, which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers. Listen to this. Let's see if you can all make this statement. This is Pauline theology, as some higher critics call it. Believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets. Well, you mean Paul believed Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5 and Leviticus 26 and 28? You mean he believed Deuteronomy 14, Leviticus 11? That's what he said. He believed not only the Psalms that were for inspiration, he believed Zechariah. He believed Nahum and Jonah and Micah and Hosea and Ezekiel and Isaiah and Daniel. The Apostle Paul said he believed it. And he said, have hope toward God, which they themselves also admit or allow, that there be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And he said, herein do I exercise myself. He lived with that hope in his life. And he said the only reason they'd made a big complaint was because he had said in verse 21 that it was concerning the resurrection of the dead that he was called in question. Now, back in chapter 26, another man who was at that time the king of the Jewish nation, Agrippa, finally asked Paul to answer for himself. And you know, Paul had to look him right in the eye, and he said in verse 8 of that 26th chapter of Acts, now in another trial, at a later occasion, he said, why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? That's a real good question. If you were asked that question today, how would you answer it? Why would you think it's a thing incredible that Christ is alive? Here are all these millions of people at Easter time. Ishtar, incidentally, was an ancient Babylonian goddess, and why you've got bunnies and eggs connected with it, well, bunnies are real rapid producers, you know, very prolific. And eggs are symbols of fertility and sex and life. You can study that if you'd like. I don't want to shock anybody. Well, maybe I do too. Shock you enough to look into an encyclopedia. I don't have any corner on the market of factual history. You can prove that to yourself. But anyhow, ostensibly, behind the scenes, the outward show of Easter used to be pronounced A-star more. We call it Easter today. It doesn't mean as opposed to Wester. You know, some little kids think Easter is the opposite of Wester, I guess. But you better look it up for yourself. But outwardly, it says to the rest of the world, we believe Jesus Christ of Nazareth walked out of his tomb. And if he did, we can. Now, I've been inside that tomb. I did a little portion of a World Tomorrow program from right on the spot inside that tomb over in Jerusalem. And you know, turning around and walking out of that tomb was quite an experience. Because I have proved to myself by many absolute proofs. I mean scientifically. I mean to where any other answer makes you an idiot. I mean where if you cannot tangibly, logically, and scientifically come up with an excuse or an answer to the contrary, you have got to admit that God exists, and you have to admit that you have proved that he exists. If you want the proof, write for it. We've got it for you. You've still got a few years where it can be academic, and you can prove it. Later on, God will take care of that for you. He'll prove it to you. But Jesus Christ is alive. He is going to return. And whether you think that's good news or not, it is. That's the best news you could ever hear. The news that Jesus Christ is alive, that he is going to intervene in the course of human affairs and set up his government on this earth, the news that he's coming to rule this earth with a rod of iron, is the best news being published today. Now, not all people like good news, but then that's just a part of the perversity of human nature. Well, write for this booklet on the wonderful world tomorrow, what it will be like. Get the one on the resurrection. Did it occur? The one on the resurrection. It's free of charge, no price. The booklet is free. The Plain Truth magazine is free. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. The booklet by the title of this program, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. And the one on the resurrection and the Plain Truth magazine, they're free of charge. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.